You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and I'm really excited about today's episode. We've got a special guest here who's going to discuss some delicious, tasty beverages with us, which I'm excited to talk about. You've probably seen conversations, pictures, videos, images floating around social media about these spirits, and so we're going to bring in the person behind it and chat in more detail and do a taste testing, which is cool because we've never done this before. So just curious how everybody's liking the butchering episodes. Last episode, we talked about the top and bottom round. So please, you know, reach out in the comments or on social media. Let us know your favorite part of that show. Let us know if we're not hitting the mark on that, if we're missing something that you'd like to hear about. But we're trying to cover everything sort of about the history of the cuts, how to remove them, how to use them, what to expect. So, and just we're all kind of focused on the big game cuts right now. So just a fun part. And then I've got some recipes you want us to talk about, even if they're from someone else. We're happy to bring them up and chat about them. And then as far as updates from me, we're in this weird time between, you know, hunting seasons here. So waterfowl closed out, your spring goose closed out, turkey's coming up next month, and then foraging hasn't kicked off yet because it's still dumping snow in random times. So we're just kind of sitting tight waiting for spring to come so we can get out after gobblers and forageables and trout and all those fun things up in the mountains. So just sit tight for that. I don't know, Adam, you got any spring activities going on?
Not really. I've been outside a lot, kind of peeking at the dirt, hoping for shoots to be popping up, checking all my spots from last year, but nothing's quite up yet. So it's a really early mild spring, so I think that I might be encountering things in a week or two, but I'll just keep going out every day with the dog and checking all my spots, and hopefully something will come up soon.
Well, thanks for the updates. Looking forward to your progress. I was going to say that you mentioned sort of like going out and looking at the ground, and just all I pictured in my head is if you guys have seen the Netflix show Narcos, where they've got the guy Pablo Escobar, now it's turned into a meme of like where he's like sitting on his swing and standing in an empty pool and just like standing in his backyard. That's what popped into my head of how you're like, you're just waiting for things to pop up, so you're just like standing there sitting on your swing out.
Yeah,
so
that's pretty much exactly what it looks like.
That's awesome. Well, no, that's a great update, thank you for that. So I'm gonna introduce our guest. He is a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in Tamworth, New Hampshire, where he focuses on product development and the production of gins, cordials, flavored spirits, and more. He is a founding member of the band Moonshine Still. You have a new Spotify follower, by the way, with whom he's played over 1,500 shows and recorded 4 albums. He's a jack of all trades and has worked awesome jobs such as antique dealer, pawn broker, canoe instructor, winery owner, distiller, student, stay-at-home dad, and in his spare time, he enjoys spending time with his children, sailing, cooking, paddling, producing music, and attempting to pursue a more sustainable lifestyle. I love it. Will Robinson, welcome to the Wild Fishing Game Podcast.
Oh, thank you guys very much. I'm excited to be here tonight.
If you could tell us a little bit more about yourself, kind of beyond what I told about you.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Georgia. Southerner by birth, got to move to New England about 11 years ago. Found New England through working as a camp counselor. And as you said earlier, I was a pursuit of music career in my 20s based out of Georgia, but we toured nationally all over the country. Played in Colorado a lot, actually. And did that for a while, started a family. Decided to come off the road, went back to college, got a degree in IT and a master's degree in outdoor education. After that, I was able to move up to New Hampshire full time and I've run a couple of schools and a couple of different camps. I've taught shop, metalworking, woodworking, audio, video, worked as an audio broadcast audio engineer before, done all kinds of different things, but I was always interested in homesteading and fermentation. And so I kept bees for a long time, and that led me into mead making, which was actually the first alcohol I ever produced. And from there into brewing, and then I found my real love of working with apples. And so I had a small winery up here for about 5 years where we made mostly traditional hard cider and some meads, what I would call session meads, not sweet, very dry, low alcohol content, about 7%, 7 to 8%, that kind of were in on par with our ciders that we produce.
That sounds awesome. So I notice, and I'll mention here in a little bit the kind of the different spirits that that I've got. But where did the idea come from to start using the wild ingredients in spirits?
Steve decided that he wanted to kind of use this as a way to grab attention somewhat and kind of just it's a way that a distillery as a whole kind of functions to draw people's attention. It's his passion project, but it also draws people's attention to what he does as an advertising magnet and as a branding magnet. So as of last year, we're a very small production facility. I can't remember how many cases we produce in a year, but last year we had 60 SKUs. So we actually were putting out 60 different products, all for chance, you know, kind of all with their stories behind them, mm-hmm. and amazing labels and graphic work. So we kind of jumped on the weird whiskey train to some degree and have just kind of been through trial and error, seeing what works with these type of spirits. And you've got a couple of them in front of you right now.
I do. Yeah, I've got I've got three here that we'll run through here in just a little bit. So I've got Saison de Frey. So that's the smoked mm-hmm. trout flavored brandy. I've got the Deer Slayer, which is the venison flavored brandy, and then the Eau du Musc, which you just talked about. So.
Yes, the Deerslayer is actually a whiskey, and then Eau de Musc is also a whiskey. Only the Saison de Frey is a brandy.
Got it.
Base. Yeah,
perfect. I'm excited. I got these bottles in like last week, and I've just had them on my counter. Adam knows me. I have been very disciplined to save them for this.
That's awesome.
I'm excited. Very, very excited. So the idea to just use the wild ingredients just kind of came as like, hey, we're going to stretch the boundaries of what people think of kind of with whiskeys and just kind of try stuff out.
Right. Kind of see what works.
Yeah.
With the Eau de Musc being the first, it was, we're kind of stuck. I mentioned earlier with what the FDA and the TTB allow. Mm-hmm. The TTB defers to the FDA for what is allowable in alcoholic beverages. When they first formed their, when the FDA first formed after shortly after Prohibition or about that time period, there were a lot of issues with. There were no aged spirits in this country after Prohibition. So there's no brown liquor. It was all clear. And people started trying to make brown liquor any way they could, which included using chromium tanned leather to color it. Yeah. So people were dying from drinking these concoctions, and they figured they needed a little food safety. So the FDA came along and they created a list that we refer to as the GRAS list, which is generally regarded as safe, G-R-A-S. And everything we make has to essentially have ingredients that are based off the GRAS list. Well, castoreum was one of the first ingredients that was allowable and seen as safe. There's no known human allergies to that particular ingredient. Like I said, it is from a beaver's, we jokingly call it anal glands because they are on either side of the anus of the beaver. But males and females have them, and they use them to kind of mark their territory with. They make mounds out of mud and detritus, and then they and some of their own excrement, and they mix that up with the castoreum. And castoreum actually acts as a fixative in the perfume industry. It's where most of the demand is for it. It holds on. It's a base note, and it holds on to the higher, more ethereal, more aromatic parts of any kind of composition that in order to make the aroma last longer. People found out initially that it was also very similar in some ways to vanilla. So at the time that was going on, vanilla was worth almost as much as silver by weight.
Wow.
So it made sense to find something. And we were hunting beaver. We were trapping beaver like mad back mm-hmm. then. So quite frequently in the first half of the 20th century, actually, before we got artificial vanillin, castoreum was frequently added to vanilla flavorings. Later on, they started using it with raspberry flavorings as well. At a lower proof, it has a very fruit-like appeal. And so we kind of played with it in both those directions. We ended up with the Eau de Musk. We actually use a raspberry. We make a raspberry distillate that goes in with that blend as well. So it's castoreum, a little bit of raspberry distillate, and then it's a bourbon base, I believe, in that one.
Nice. I'm gonna open it up here. So what you want to walk me through? I guess we can just give it a go. Walk me through a little bit on what I should be doing.
Okay. When you first open any bottle of spirits, you're going to catch the aromatics that are volatilized at that proof. As you add water to spirit, you bring the proof down. You're increasing the amount of water in the solution. The compounds that are more soluble in water are able to become volatilized and then evaporate. And so it will actually change the way the spirit smells and tastes if you really pay attention to it as the proof goes down. So it also spreads it. To me, it kind of spreads it out onto a spectrum to where you can pick certain aspects out a little bit easier.
Wow. I taste the raspberry and the vanilla, but the raspberry hit kind of after. It's interesting. Fascinating me. I like it. This is good.
Where are you sourcing your castoreum? Are you out there individually milking beavers, or are you working with small trappers?
So we work with a nuisance trapper. I get the glands and cure them myself. I get them fresh from him and cure them so that we can make sure everything stays to high quality for food standards.
That's cool.
Flavor and aroma molecules are very, very delicate organic molecules, all carbon-based, and they have a tendency to denature under heat, so they break down. And so by distilling under a vacuum, I can actually distill at 125 degrees Fahrenheit, and that protects a lot of those really delicate flavor and aroma molecules and allows us to capture them in a clear distillate. And that distillate, then we go back and we're able to flavor products with without worrying about it making it cloudy or changing the color, that type of stuff. And it really does with a lot of the ingredients that we use. If depending on how you design the distillation process, it can leave the spirit tasting exactly like the botanical or the animal product tastes. The crab is really interesting that way. And that it smells very, very off-putting, like very strong crab aroma. The distillate, though, not the whiskey.
Yeah, the distillate. The whiskey.
Yeah, just the ingredient that goes into it. It's very, very crabby. But when you taste it, it doesn't have that off-putting taste. It actually tastes like freshly cooked crab meat. Really interesting process that my fellow that I work with, Matt Power, has developed. And really, there's not a lot of people out there doing this. And so we have to develop techniques kind of on the fly to work with these ingredients, because there's no book written on any of this. We're kind of finding our way through the dark.
That's cool. That's very cool. And I'm bummed because the Crab Trapper, ironically, that's the one that drew me into this conversation. And that's the one that I couldn't find it online to purchase. So I don't have it today. Yep. But
it's been hard keeping up with demand after it went viral 2 years ago. Yeah.
So. Yeah, I could imagine too. And I mean, how much do you guys, because you said earlier you don't produce a whole lot, but these are what, bottle 200 milliliters or so? Yeah. How much?
So usually about 600 bottles per batch, you know, so not a very big batch. That's like usually around 30 to 35 gallons per batch for that product in particular. And I may make the crab 4 or 5 times a year, something like that. Wow. I did last year at least. So we went through quite a bit of it. But that, you know, that story going viral was pretty crazy. That's, we hadn't really ever experienced that before.
That's awesome, though. That's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So, all right, should we move on? Or do you want to talk about the Crab Trapper? Since we're kind of on the topic, do you want to talk about it a little bit?
Sure. So that was actually the first product that they had me design. I came in and my background, I had taught environmental education for 4 years and run an environmental education day camp. So I was very intimately familiar with invasive species and things that people have done to try to bring more awareness to them and encourage people to eat them, such as the lionfish initiative down in the Keys, or the Asiatic carp in the Midwest. There's been a lot of programs, you know, like for people trying to get more people to eat them. So I knew that UNH had a program like this. So I reached out to the head of their Sea Grant, Dr. Gabriella Brott, and I asked her what she thought, you know, about the idea. And she said she thought it was great. You know, she had connections at the FDA, so she was able to get in touch with them and see what they thought as far as us using the crab in a product would be. They said to just call it crab and go for it. And so we went forward with it. A lot of people were like, I was afraid to tell people that I was working on a crab bourbon, crab flavored bourbon for a while. But being from the Deep South and learning, I've also worked as a chef. So I'm very familiar with seafood and cooking, Southern style seafood, East Coast style seafood, some Asian as well. You know, I knew that foods like Thai foods that use fish sauce, if you've ever taken a whiff of fish sauce straight out of the bottle, it's repulsive. However, when you can find something that has that funk and you can come up with the right kind of spices to go along with it, it elevates the dish to a level that it wouldn't be at without it. You know, it adds this kind of thing to it, this depth that you wouldn't have otherwise with the funkiness. So I knew the crab would work that way. I played around initially with some Asian ingredients, Japanese type ingredients, but I ended up settling on the East Coast American seafood spice blend, which has a very interesting history. It's been used for almost 300 years on the East Coast of the U.S. as a way to curb offensive seafood flavor, particularly in a time when there was no refrigeration. So you might know some of these modern spice blends have evolved into what Zatarain's crab boil or Old Bay seasoning. So they have quite a few different ingredients, but I ended up developing my own kind of clone that I knew would work in spirits. We have to in spirits we can't use alliums, so we can't use garlic or onions because of the amount of sulfur in them.
Okay.
It would be very off-putting. So cut those out, and I came up with an 8-spice blend that is it contained paprika, mustard seed, dill seed, bay leaf, coriander, cinnamon, clove, and allspice.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I got those balanced with the whiskey that I was working with, which was one of our bourbon reserves. And once I got that working with that, I knew it worked with the crab. And so wham bam, we put it together. And I actually rode around with it in my truck in a tiny little vial for about a month or two before I even showed it to anybody else, because I just had to keep smelling it. I was like, this smells so crazy. I can't, it's not like anything I've ever smelled before, but I have to keep smelling it. I like, just to make sure I wasn't losing my mind that but it ended up doing well. They were very happy with it right off the bat. Like as far as the aroma and the taste, fascinating product to work on, and really interesting connecting with the fishing community here locally as well to obtain the crab. And I've been talking to several folks locally who are still working with local crab fishermen who are trying to develop more of a market for it, actually for the soft shell variety of them and how to predict them. There's a whole culture of eating these little guys. The green crabs are very small, so there's not a lot of meat. So picking them is very tedious, and most people don't want to do that. But they're native to Italy. And part to other parts of Europe, and in parts of Italy, they've been eating them for centuries, and they've passed down the knowledge of recognizing them when they're going to molt, you know, and having that whole process. So we have this small group of Americans here in Maine that are working towards creating a viable market for the soft shell green crab, and bringing all of this attention to the whole thing that the whiskey has done. That's actually done a lot to further their cause, which was my point in the first place. We don't use that many crabs in it to actually make a dent in their population, but just making folks aware. That was part of me, you know, as a career educator. Most of my life as an educator, I saw it as an opportunity to teach people about global warming and how these things are impacting us on a local level. And it accomplished that.
That's awesome. So no, I think it's cool. And you know, I cut my teeth in the chef world down in New Orleans, and like grew up on Gulf Coast seafood. Oh, awesome. And it's like, yeah, I saw that, and that's like immediately caught my attention. I was like, the flavor and complexness of it. I was just like, this is something that seems, one, out of this world, and two, just like cool. And then the story of, you know, the invasiveness of those crabs, and I'm just like, this is great.
That's
like,
awesome.
This is one of those products that you see and you're just like, I want to support it because it hits so many good boxes, in my opinion. And I think that's like, that's where I landed. And, yeah, I'll keep an eye out. Awesome. As soon as the next batch comes out, I'll be there holding my money, ready to go.
It should be shipping the mail order within the next few weeks. So
okay.
I just finished bottling another batch. So, yeah.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. Okay. No, awesome that you spent time in New Orleans. I have family from Uma, Louisiana. That's where I learned to make gumbo. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Learned all my low country cooking from my uncle from Uma. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Love New Orleans. Yeah.
I would say, so is there a gumbo whiskey in the works? Because that would be great.
I haven't pushed that one yet. I do make a gumbo every year for New Year's, and I treat my New England friends with it, the ones who really like it, because you can't. It's really few and far between to find good gumbo up here.
I lived up in Boston for a while, and it becomes a hot commodity real quick. So,
yeah, definitely.
When you go out there and the fish are where you think they are, any one of these casts could be the bite. It's the most exciting fishing that I know right here at Hawk's Cave.
Oh, that's awesome.
Experience the best saltwater fishing the world has to offer. Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience, brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts, every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. On Mondays, head offshore with Captain Scott Walker and Steve Roger for breathtaking deep sea adventures.
Coming to me.
Double. He's jumping.
Oh!
Look at that belly.
Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
Tell a few fish stories along the way.
On Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
All right. Well, should we move on to the Deer Slayer I've got here?
Sure.
So I'll open it up. Let me finish. We got one last sip.
All right.
And I'll open it up. So this one's cool. It's got a little wax cap on it.
I cap it. You open it.
So this one definitely smells very different than the Audemars.
So whiskey base once again. This one only has one ingredient outside of the whiskey base, though, but we do a lot of work to prepare that ingredient. So we take venison shoulder roasts, and then we grind those. We add green peppercorns, juniper berries, porcini mushrooms, a little bit of dextrose, a little bit of salt, and then a fermenting, like a culture for fermenting meat, for making like a salami, that type of culture. And so we mix all that. We grind up all the spices. They get mixed in to the ground meat, and then we let it ferments for 24 hours at about 75 degrees, and that acidifies it, prevents any kind of pathogens from growing in it, but also gives it that sausage twang that you may be familiar with any kind of – with typical yep. fermented sausages. And then I smoke it. So I take it – I'm also a big barbecue guy. I've got a huge barbecue rig that I do for folks up here for parties and weddings and that kind of stuff on the side.
Man, Will, so we just become we best friends because
– Hey, you know, you're welcome out here anytime, man. I love to have people come visit. So.
I appreciate that. I may take you up.
I've got a trailer sized smoker, and last summer for the parents' visitation at the camp that I used to work at, I spent the night down there camped out in my truck camper and smoked 500 pounds of brisket for them.
Wow!
Yeah, we play with meat a lot. We let meat and wood fire. That I love protein and wood fire. That's one of my favorite things. So. The venison gets smoked, and then we break it back down. It gets smoked in these patties, and then we kind of break those up, food process them to really fine, and then that gets steeped in the whiskey, and then we distill that on the rotary evaporator. So it ends up with a clear distillate, even though using the whiskey as a base. Then we blend that distillate back into barrel strength whiskey and proof it to the appropriate bottle strength, and that's pretty much the way it goes.
That's cool. So as I'm tasting this, I'm trying to make sense in my mind of what's going on here. Could you roadmap it a little for me? I think I need.
Yeah. So it is meaty. Mm-hmm. We have this fermented smoked venison sausage with porcinis, green peppercorn, and juniper berries in it. So on the low end, mm-hmm. off the bat, you're going to notice the smoke. That's probably the predominant one. There's a little bit of that sour acidity from the fermented meat, just a hint of the juniper and a hint of the porcini, which is kind of like this earthy funk in the bottom.
I think that's what was getting me. I was like, I'm trying to figure out in my mind what this last like note is that I'm hitting, and I think that was the porcini and all that. So
yeah, the porcinis have a definite funk to them. They're very very earthy, kind of kind of funky. Dirty socks almost.
So I'm gonna do some with ice here, so please don't wait for me.
Yeah. No, so yeah, once again it will open up a little bit as you sip on it that way. This one is pretty straightforward. It's been a really popular one. It was actually on David Spade's game show.
Oh, cool.
Called Snake Oil this past fall. Steve, our owner, went on the very first episode of that game show, and they're trying to trick the contestants into like whether this company is real or not, or whether this product is real. So he went on there with Deerslayer and was talking about our beaver anus whiskey, on national television, and they didn't think it was real. They didn't think he was real. So that was pretty cool.
Are you getting like any umami notes coming from the mushrooms and meat in that tasting, Justin?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Definitely, the fermentation process actually adds a lot of umami to it as
Adam's
well.
Like, I can see Adam's face, he's very jealous right now.
I just got drool marks all over my shirt.
Matt and I joke about this one, because generally when we're making it, after it's smoked and it's cooled back down, before as we're going back into the infusion with it, we always end up eating handfuls of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've debated... like it would make an excellent like meat stick product, and so we've kind of been floating that idea around a little bit. Once we've got a new a piece of land that they've charged me because I've got a little bit of design background, so I got to design our our new timber frame barrel house that's going up next summer. 40, a huge 4,000 square foot, 40 by 100 timber frame, that a friend of mine is actually building. But, where was I going with that? I just lost my train of thought.
Talking about the, making sausage products.
So once we get more of our facility moved out to the land where all that is, we're eventually going to build another production facility out there. And we've been talking about partnering with someone to raise cattle so that we can use the spent stillage as fodder for the cattle instead of having to worry to dispose of that. But then we could use the cattle to make meat sticks that are very similar to the deer slayer.
I was going to say, it reminds me, so there's this bar in Key West. So I used to live in Key West.
Where have you been at all the hot holiday spots?
yep. Well, I'm headed to D.C. next. So, I'm sorry. Yeah, not quite as party there. but there's this bar there called Mary Ellen's. And you can go in and you get a Mary Ellen special. And it's a pint of PBR, a shot of wild turkey, and a Slim Jim. Wow. And I just pictured like an upscale version of that in my mind when you were like, we could make a snack stick type product. And I'm like, oh, you could get a Deer Slayer, whiskey with this like smoked meat, delicious porcini snack stick along with it and like a pint of beer.
Like a juniper green peppercorn saison or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
That's what popped into my mind, but my mind works in mysterious ways.
No, that's great. That's great. I lovingly call the distillate that we make from this hot dog water because it is very reminiscent of hot dog water. That ferment, I didn't realize how much the fermentation of the meat plays into what we know of as the flavor of hot dogs. There actually is some fermentation that goes on there. Yeah, so I keep saying we need to partner up with like Nathan's or somebody and do like a Green Monster hot dog water whiskey. But I don't know if they're ever going to go that route.
Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience, brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts, every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Through the Blackwater Bayous and in the dark Louisiana night floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest. Me and the Duck Camp Dinners crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
All right, so we'll move on to the Saison du Frais.
All right.
I'm excited about this one as well.
Are you a brandy drinker at all?
Yes and no.
Okay. I just started getting into it, actually. I've been trying, I remember trying them when I was younger and it being a bit too much for me. And then I got into ryes and bourbons eventually and scotch lately. And then the last just maybe 6 months, I've been really enjoying brandy a lot more. So I think that seems to be my next exploration into brown liquors.
You should, my favorite, this has nothing to do with us, but my favorite brown liquor is Armagnac. If you're not familiar, you should definitely check it out. It's a specific type of French brandy that's made from a particular varietal in a particular region of France. And from what I understand, like France makes most of their cognac for export. They keep the Armagnac for themselves. Like it's that kind of spirit. And it's one of the few that here in New Hampshire, we've got relatively cheap spirits because our socialized liquor sales, which I love, but not everybody does. But I can get a 25 year old bottle of Armagnac for less than $100 here in New Hampshire. And it's almost a perfect scoring liquor. It's like a 97 to a 98 Boss Armagnac. It's amazing. It's like caramel and butterscotch and like just really, really candy-like. But our brandy here is made from apples, and they all come from New Hampshire, from New Hampshire's oldest continuously operating orchard, actually. And we love the brand. Everybody who works with me, including Steve, who owns the distillery, brandy is our favorite. Apple brandy is our favorite, but it's a hard sell in the United States because It's in the same ballpark flavor-wise as whiskey. And you're trying to convince whiskey drinkers to take on a new product. That's not going to happen. So it is kind of a hard sell, and it's disappointing for us. We're hoping that some of this attention, you know, like particularly this product, stays on to Frey, can open up the market just a little bit more, because we really like to focus more of our efforts on brandy.
So is that kind of like a Calvados? Because that's a brandy that I've actually enjoyed for most of my adult life. Yeah.
We produce apple brandy in the Calvados style, a very similar style.
Okay, cool.
So it's a double. We have a copper pot still, and we do a double pot distillation on our brandy, no column. So it goes straight. Those very, very traditional way of manufacturing. So this one's really interesting. You get a little bit of the smoke too. This is a smoked rainbow trout, actually. We worked with a company out of Idaho that belongs to a very famous television producer. He used to produce Ally McBeal, and he owns, I can't remember, David I can't remember his name offhand, but anyway, he owns a company that is the largest trout farming operation in North America. And we opted to go with them to source our fish because it was just more sustainable that way. They're very sustainable in their practice. So this is another one that's a very simple one. It is just the smoked trout and the brandy. And we just kind of blended them together. What was really interesting is that there's this characteristic in the trout somewhere between the smoke and the fish that's very similar to apple. And it got to the point where I was like, I couldn't tell if it was in it sometimes. Yeah, it's very, very different than the others. They are all very, very unique in their own right.
Yeah, that's, holy smokes. So when I opened the bottle, I smelt the apple like right away.
Yeah.
As I taste, like that smoked trout flavor just, it hit very prominent in that like first sip.
Oh yeah, it's right there up front.
Yeah, and it's the brininess too is there, but pleasant.
Right. I like to paint pictures sort of with just kind of create a scene. And to me, this one, I used to make so when I owned the winery and we made a lot of apple cider, I used to take a lot of apples and I would make apple butter. I don't know if you're familiar with that product or the process, but like copper pot, wood fire, you know, 2 days of cooking the stuff, you know, over a wood fire. And so it gets a little bit of the smoke flavor in it as well. And so this product, I kind of describe it as like a fall New England scene on a riverbank where, a settler family is actually making apple butter. But it's fall. It's been raining maybe a little bit. You can smell the wood smoke from the fire. You can smell the apple butter bubbling. And you get these wisps every now and then of the fishy kind of river smell, you know, the living smell of the river. And that's kind of what that's what that product tastes like to me. That's kind of that experience for it.
I feel like I can taste it.
Yeah. Here, Adam, I'll pass it. No, you're spot on that. And that's a beautiful picture to paint. I really like that. So I like all three, but this one may have slid to the top of my list so far.
Right on.
So
that was actually, I got to go to Philly and hang out with some kind of quote unquote well-known culture writers who write specifically on spirits a lot. I think one of them actually co-wrote a book with Steve on spirits, but that the Saison de Frey was their favorite as well. They've been around us since the upstart and they loved it. They joked, they were like, why'd you use brandy though? Nobody wants to buy brandy. Nobody wants to run a story on brandy. They all want whiskey. So
I think that's cool though, that like that apple flavor pairs so well.
Yeah.
With it.
And that's our 4-year VSOP as the base. We sell a 7-year on site that we have. That's our real choice stuff. It's called in the brandy world, 4 years VSOP, very special old pale. And then you get Napoleon at 7 years. And then at 10, you get XO. So pretty soon here, we're going to have an XO and just our brandy line. Ooh. But yeah. It's good stuff.
So I had the ice in there.
Yep.
I had the ice in there. It's melted now, and that trout flavor's there.
It's really unique. It's aroma, smells, and tastes are very, very strongly attuned to our memories. And so I kind of always want to set out to either, when I'm creating something, I either want to create something that evokes memories in people, that's a smell that everybody is really familiar with, and they smell it, and it I haven't done any spirits with it yet, but I've been working with a couple different types of seaweed to try to determine something to do with that. And the horsetail kelp that we have here on the northern portion of the East Coast, when I worked it into a distillate and I walked around and I just let people at work smell it and tell me what they thought, every single one of them named the beach that they grew up on, even though it was a different beach in a different part of the country. It smelled the same to all of them, and it brought back that childhood memory of being at that beach. And so, we're working, we're either like trying to tap into those kind of memories or create a new experience altogether. And so a lot of what we do with House of Tamworth is creating that new experience, that new flavor and aroma that mm-hmm. People just haven't experienced before, you know, and it creates a new memory and a connection there.
So I guess my question with that is, so have you, you know, with these flavors, particularly, I guess, like the Deer Slayer and the Saison de Frey, like, In talking to people who like hunt or fish, do you see more of a connection for like this brings back a memory versus creating a memory?
To some degree, yes, it definitely has. And I mean, that's been a lot of the people who've been ended up purchasing this product are people who are outdoor enthusiasts. And so, yeah, no, it definitely does. That it kind of ties in there for sure to those memories.
What other spirits do you guys have that I need to put on my radar or that our listeners need to put on their radar?
What do you like, I guess, would be my question.
Everything. Anything? I'm like excited about everything.
So our rye is really highly regarded. Our Chikuro rye, it's my favorite aged spirit that we make. Very good, very mixable, very approachable, just straight on the rocks, or I drink it with just seltzer and ice. The Chikuro rye is fantastic. Like I said, our VSOP and our Napoleon brandy that we have is amazing. I got to make it's not a true absinthe, but they let me run wild with it, and I grew the wormwood and created a product that's kind of what would be considered in the absinthe world a faux absinthe. But I started off with a 19th century French recipe for absinthe. But we have this other product that we needed to use that we use a lot of fruit. We make a Damson plum gin. We make several cordials that use local blueberries, local raspberries, honeyberries, and aronia berries. And so we try to line up all of those at the same time. So when we're done with the infusion and we have like, you know, 700 pounds of plums left over that have been soaking in spirit for, you know, 4 months, we'll take those and then we'll add water to it and put the rest of the fruit in there and add water. And what it does is the water will draw the alcohol out of the fruit that's been sitting in infusion. And then we'll let that sit for another, you know, couple months. And then we'll distill that to make this base we call sugar plum base. And what it's a grain based alcohol, you know, because we use our neutral spirit to steep those fruit in. But what happens is that as it's distilled on the big still, on the hot still, the aromatics that are left in that fruit come across with the distillate. So you end up with this really old timey candy like kind of almost like spun sugar, whatever they call it. I can't even think of the word right now. In Europe, they call it sugar floss. I can't think of the American name.
Cotton candy.
There you go.
Cotton candy fart.
Yeah. So cotton candy. It has these cotton candy notes. And then we age it at a low proof for about 2 years in a barrel. And by aging at a low proof, like what I was telling you earlier about solubility in spirits, sugars are way more soluble in water than they are spirits. So when you barrel age at a low proof, you get wood sugars in your whatever you're aging. So it ends up being a lot sweeter, a lot of the more caramel kind of sugary, like burnt sugar aspects of the oak. So we take that that aged sugar plum base. I make a literal absinthe concentrate using wormwood, fennel seed, anise seed, hyssop, and lemon balm. And let's see, what else has that got? Angelica and gentian root as well. So all of that in it, and then the sugar plum base is blended together. And then you as foragers, you guys will appreciate this one. Have you guys ever had Magolio? Or are you familiar with Magolio?
So, yeah, like the pine syrup,
right? It's from Italy, from the Mogo pine. Typically, that's where it gets its name. I did a bunch of research, and most of what I could find was that the white pine was the best one to use here in North America to do it. And only problem is, after talking to several tree guys, is that white pines only throw cones once every 5 years, and they only throw them in the top third of the tree. So it's like 120 feet off the ground, and they're only ripe for 2 months. Hmm. So it just happened last year. We got some bad storms, and Matt had several white pines blow down on his property. And he called me immediately. He's like, man, these are loaded with cones. You got to come get them. So I spent like 2 or 3 days foraging fresh green pine cones. You know, they're about the size of your thumb. And you macerate and ferment those in
sticky job.
Sticky job. Yeah, I know. I definitely wore gloves for that one. We macerate those in an equal weight of sugar. So the sugar acts like the same way that you cure bacon with salt. The sugar draws the moisture out of the cones. Mm-hmm. And over the course of 30 days, you have these little spots of fermentation where as the water is being drawn out of the cone, before it becomes completely saturated with sugar, there's the sugar content is low enough to allow some yeast and bacteria to live and ferment. And so it bubbles. You mix it, shake it up daily. After about 30 days, all of the sugar has completely dissolved. I've added no liquid to it, but it is a total volume of liquid. I let it sit for another month until it's completely done fermenting, and then you simmer the cones and then strain them and filter them as if I was making maple syrup. And it has the most amazing flavor. It is not pine-like at all. It's not like turpentine. It's not like pine tar. Because it's a sugar maceration, only the water-soluble compounds come out of the cones. So all those compounds that are solvent-soluble, such as the terpenes and the things that you would associate normally with a pine aroma, you don't get any of that in the syrup. Instead, you get this kind of fruity, fermented, really delicious, fermented sort of fruity smell that if you've ever milled fresh pine, if you've ever cut pine that was still wet or been around a tree that's getting cut, it actually, the wood ferments slightly and it smells exactly like that. So it's this absinthe I got to make is kind of a combination of these herbs and these weeds, wormwood essentially being a weed, that grow on the fringes of big hay pastures, mixed with this magolio, this white pine magolio that smells like a walk in the woods. And so you get this our absinthe kind of paints this picture of a warm southern New England day, and you're kind of crossing a field coming up to the forest, and you can smell the warm southern breeze kind of blowing the smell of the woods into the field. And it was a very, very interesting product. My favorite thing that I've ever designed, actually. But it takes about 2 years to make, so we only put it out about every 2 years.
That's awesome.
When's the next batch coming out?
We have some now. When's the next batch? I don't know that it's up for. I don't know that we ship it out of state. I don't know that it's with any of our distributors. It may just be an in-house and an in-state thing right now. But it's just a neat story, and I knew you guys would appreciate.
We'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah, I knew you guys would appreciate the foraged pine cone syrup. So.
Yeah.
I actually made that this year for the first time in the spring with Austrian pine.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's something truly special. It's really, really interesting, difficult to describe, beautiful flavor that I haven't had anywhere else.
It is amazing. Yeah, it's not something.
Good job describing like the sense of it with like a freshly cut pine or something. Yeah. It's really neat.
You know, I have several friends who have sawmills, including the guy who's building our barrel house, and so I've spent time working with them. And while I was in the midst of making it, I went over there and I was actually sawing with one of them. I was like, "Holy cow! This is exactly what that stuff smells like every time we cut into a log." It's pretty neat. We're wanting to try a similar maceration with some spruce tips this year. Maybe we use spruce a lot because we have a lot of spruce up here.
I was like, that reminds me, we get spruce tips and I make spruce tip syrups, and we use it in place of like maple syrup and stuff, even with my kids. Mm-hmm. My kids love it. And like that spruce tip, just letting it sit in the sugar and just letting it do that whole process. It's easy.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's really cool. Really cool. Yeah. I actually did an experiment with the cones, and I got maple sugar, since we're in the heart of maple country for North America, mm-hmm. here, I mean for the United States at least. And I actually macerated some of them in the maple, and that is like being in the forest. You take a spoon of that in your mouth. It's just like you are in the woods.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I guess my next question is looking forward, anything that you can share with us that's on the horizon that we should keep an eye out for new flavors, new spirits, anything like that?
We're always experimenting. So like right now we're playing around with different types of poultry. That's all I can say. We called it the Bird of Courage. It was a full Thanksgiving dinner. For the 450th or whatever that anniversary, 400th anniversary of the first Thanksgiving. But we did roast turkey, and all these ingredients were local too. So the turkeys were raised in Tamworth. We had roast squash. I went and picked, we have several cranberry bogs locally that are open to the, that are kind of like commons. So I went and picked cranberries. I went and picked wild apples, made applesauce, made cranberry sauce. We had somebody grow flint corn. We made a flint corn stuffing with locally grown sage and celery. And all of those were different distillates that went into the final product. And it was, I swear you could sit there and be like, oh yeah, turkey. There's the cranberry. There's the apple. Oh, and it finishes up with a little bit of the winter squash, you know, the roast squash. It was really interesting, but that was one we will not remake, but we've been investigating kind of some other poultry that has a little bit more, kind of a little gamier, a little bit more flavor to it. So we'll see what comes of that. I'm not really sure at this point. We kind of have to just see if it works.
No, that's exciting. Very cool. Yeah. I'll wait on the fringe until it happens.
And they charged me with making a rum, coming up with a flavored rum for them last year as well, which is coming up for nationwide mail order. It's called Siege of Wolves. It's a story about that happened here in Tamworth in 1830 that was printed in the New York Times a number of years later. But they were after the, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Year Without a Summer, 1815, 1816. There was a giant volcano that exploded somewhere. It was not Krakatoa, but it was another one that exploded somewhere in the Pacific. And it caused a volcanic winter, you know, what we call a nuclear winter these days. And they had, here in Tamworth, we had snow 12 months out of the year. They had a frost every month out of the year. So a lot of animals died. A lot of seafood got eaten because no crops would grow. And the number of predators really grew. So there were wolves here at the time. And the number of wolves really started to take off, and it became a problem. And by 1830, 15 years later, it had really come to a head. And the town put out a bounty. 600 men showed up during this particular time period to try to hunt these wolves out that were just killing sheep everywhere. Raising sheep was the predominant type of agriculture that was happening here at the time. And so they only ended up killing about five or six, but the town paid this group of men $80, and we kind of took a little bit of creative license, and because we know that when our townhouse was built here in Tamworth, that they paid the guys who did the construction a cask of rum as their payment for building the townhouse. So we went ahead and just took the leap of faith that like 600 men, $80, they probably just bought a cask of rum to share between themselves. And so we also kind of, I did a little bit of digging and came up with a story for, early shopkeepers in New England all had rum for sale. They had rum and they had molasses and they had cheese and whatever else. But America's rum consumption was so heavy at that time period that it barely had time to age. So you were lucky to find a rum that was 3 years old. It was mostly just aged between the time that it left the Caribbean and made it up here to New England. So savvy shopkeepers would flavor it in different ways in order to make it seem older than it was. Today, we kind of call that black rum, where they'll add molasses to it or they'll add other types. Tea is another one that was popularly added to it to give it more tannins, like it had been in the oak longer. And so I had been studying all these early soda recipes and these early tonic recipes, you know, like the Coca-Cola and Cherry Coke, Dr. Pepper, Moxie. All of these were actually tonics that were derived at pharmacies and sold as medicines before they ever became sodas. And I believe personally that evolved out of flavoring some of these rum, you know, essentially, you know, like coming up with these tonics that they could make and just trying to sell more of the rum quickly. So I developed this recipe for a 3 to 5 year Caribbean blend. So we buy in a 3 to 5 year old Caribbean blend, and then I add maple syrup to it. I steep roast chicory in it. I steep oolong tea in it. And then I use the flavors star anise, which is licorice, sweet sweet birch, which is wintergreen, and bitter almond, which is amaretto. And I balance those three because amaretto, if you're familiar, amaretto is the key flavor for Cherry Coke and Dr. Pepper. The mix of wintergreen and licorice gives you sassafras, gives you a root beer, because we can't use sassafras legally anymore. It was one of the first substances that was banned in the 20s. It's true sassafras extract. Safrole oil is a carcinogen at super high doses. Nothing to worry about. My dad's a doctor. He used to laugh at me making sassafras tea. I used to forage sassafras out of my backyard and make tea out of it when I was a kid. But it's not truly that strong of a carcinogen. The kicker, though, is that safrole is a precursor to making MDMA. So you can make ecstasy out of sassafras. So it's a marked chemical. The DEA doesn't want you using it. And the FDA does not allow it. So people figured out shortly after it got banned that if you blended licorice and wintergreen at the right proportions and you had a little bit of caramel and a little bit of vanilla in the background, it tastes exactly like sassafras. So, but then wintergreen on its own is what they use over in Maine to make Moxie. I don't know if you guys have ever had Moxie before, but that's a regional soda from Maine.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I have. Yeah.
You should look out for it. It's really
like a birch beer soda.
It's kind of like a birch beer soda. And birch beer is, you know, like that same birch flavoring, that wintergreen flavor. It has some gentian root in it too, so it's a little bit bitter on the back end. But it comes in a bright orange can. You could buy it at any gas station in New England. But it is definitely one of those regional sodas. So anyway, I wanted this rum to kind of be a combination of all of these different sodas, you know, like their origin, and balance those flavors to where, you know, there's not one on top of the other. And it came out really well, and it's been selling like mad. So that's one that we're hoping to grow to a national brand, actually. So Seizure Wolves, you may see that one out there, too, if you look for our mail order stuff.
Heck yeah. So that's super exciting. I'm a big rum guy.
Rum is my thing,
too. In the South, love it. I love it. Which is sadly a challenge that I've found in Colorado of finding good rums, but I'm dealing with it. I found some gems in the rough.
Yeah, I had a buddy bring me the 7-year old Cuban. I can't remember what the brand is. What is it?
It's not just Havana Club.
You guys have it in Canada.
Yeah, we can't get it here legally at stores. No, but people bring it back now.
Gosh, well they made a Puerto Rican version of it.
Right.
Not Havana Club.
Havana Club. Yeah, yeah.
Havana Club. So buddy brought me a bottle of that, of the age stuff. He brought it for my birthday last year. And he's like, when this was put in the barrel, Castro was still alive. You know?
That's awesome. Yes. Yeah. That is a great thought. So where can people go to order the spirits, purchase the spirits? You know, obviously they could come there and visit you guys, but if they're out of state like us, where's the best place?
So it is tamworthdistilling.com. If you're in New Hampshire, obviously you can order directly from us and we can mail order, or you can pick up in house. If you're, we use Sealbach and Big Thirst to do our mail order. And I think between the two of them, they cover 38 states. So you can order directly through our website. A lot of these products.
Got it. Yep, I'm on there now. The other question that I had is what's the best way people to connect, generally social media questions or anything like that? What's a good way to reach you guys?
You can email us through the website at info.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, we are on Instagram. We're all over Instagram.
Let's see. Tamworth_distilling is Instagram.
We'll throw that in the show notes
if people want to reach out to you and the website links.
Yeah. Info. And if you have direct questions, specific questions, info@tamworthdistilling.com. And I actually see those too. So they all come to my inbox as well. And we all kind of just field through, like dig through and see who needs to answer what. But we're happy to answer any kind of questions people have.
Sweet. You know, we're nearing on time here. And kind of our last closeout is we just do kind of like an around the room for any like misfires, alibis, last notes, our thoughts. So I'll kick it over to you, Will, if you have anything you want to leave us or the guests with before we close out.
Yeah, just don't be afraid to try strange things. that would be my kicker. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised in the end if you're not scared to expand your horizons or just try something new. I also like, you know, I part of this, I don't consume a lot of alcohol myself. And so moving to this smaller format, I honestly, the Xennials and some of these generations below us do not drink like my generation. I'm 46 years old. I have friends who've drank themselves to death already. So it's a serious thing to learn to do this all responsibly. Mm-hmm. And me working in manufacturing in particular. But I like the idea of these small bottles that are extremely focused on the flavor, as opposed to massive consumption, binge drinking, and whatnot. And so I kind of see this as a potential, you know, an outlet for the future of alcohol consumption, if we do continue down this path towards reduced consumption.
No, yeah, I like it. Smart. Adam, what you got?
Well, first off, if you ever plan on sitting in on a podcast where people are going to be drinking awesome sounding whiskeys and brandies, make sure you have some yourself. It's pretty difficult. Secondly, I think in the pursuit of wild food, it's something we've talked a lot about in the past, and something I really enjoy about it is that every meal you have has a story. So it wasn't just like, well, I don't know, I picked up some chicken breasts from the grocery store and whatever. You had to plan, you had to train, you had to like get out there and do it, and you might have had some misadventures or some adversity, and you got to see probably some beauty, and you had some emotional roller coaster rise, and you had to do the whole butchering, and then eventually the storing and the cooking, and eventually gets on your plate, and there's a story to be told about everything you're eating. And listening to Will's stories of how they came up with these alcohols and how they came to be in the paintings he kind of, or the pictures he painted for us, reminded me of that too. And I think that these really cool sounding liquors with a story are really attractive to me. Like you said, opposed to the Costco bottle of vodka or whatever. I think food or drinks with a story is really where it's at. So thanks for sharing everything. Yeah.
Conscious consumption, consciously consuming.
Yeah. I like it. And to me too, and I'll end on this note here in a bit, but I'm blown away. So I initially said it was a big challenge and discipline to like not just tap into these and kind of go off the cuff and taste them on my own. I'm like 100% happy that I did this, and I recommend to anybody, and maybe I should have opened up with this, of like, pause this podcast, order the spirits, and then like taste them along as we're going. You know, if you're listening to this podcast now, maybe go back, order everything, and then just listen to it and taste everything as you go. Cause it was a cool experience, I think, just to understand, like Adam mentioned, the story behind it, the flavors, just to kind of like dance through everything, and like phenomenal. I can't wait. You guys have earned a fan. I'm there. So
awesome, man.
No, thanks for everything. Thanks for taking the time to walk us through all this and just discuss it. And, you know, please like carry on the good work for our sake.
Will do, man. Thank you guys. I appreciate it a lot.
Awesome.
It was great.
Likewise.
To meet you.
And for everybody out there listening, you know, thanks for listening. And we'll include all these show notes online. We'll give a nice little detailed summary and just have everything linked so you can go click through and read and digest things on your own. And then make sure head over to social media. Make sure you follow Harvesting Nature, Adam, the Intrepid Eater, and then Tamworth Distilling. Go follow those guys too so you can stay on top of what cool new stuff they've got coming out. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, please punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, tell us we're doing right, or, you know, tell us we're doing wrong. Thanks, everybody, and have a good night.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
I'm Will Cooper, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. If you haven't already, download the free Waypoint TV app to listen to our podcast and watch the original films from Hunt Stand Presents anywhere, anytime, and on any device.